Today's Taisho will be on Case 28 in the Wumong Kong, the Umen Kwang, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 28 is entitled Ryutan Blows Out the Candle. Tokusan asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryutan said, "The night is late. Why don't you retire?" Tokusan made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Tokusan was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Tokusan went through a deep experience and made bows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," said Tokusan, I will not doubt the words of an old Osho who is renowned everywhere under the sun." The next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick, and he won't turn his head to look at you. Some day or other, he will climb the highest of the peaks and establish the way there." Tokusan brought his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front hall, pointed to them with a torch, and said, "Even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, it is like placing a hair of your head in a vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water dripped on the great ocean." And he burned all his notes. Then, making bows, he took leave of his teacher. Mumon's comment: before Tokusan crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrines of special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Ryushu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh the mind. "Your worship," the old woman said, "what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," replied Tokusan. The old woman said, "I hear it is said in the sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to refresh?" At this question, Tokusan was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teacher around here?" The old woman said, "5 miles from here, you will find Ryutan Osho." Coming to Ryutan, Tokusan got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones. As for Ryutan, he seemed to have lost all shame in his compassion towards his son. Finding a bit of live coal in the other, enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mumon's verse: hearing the name cannot surpass seeing the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning and practicing Zen. Please understand that when I thank you, I'm not engaging in an empty formality. I'm really genuinely happy to see each of you here. I love Zen practice, and I literally get up every day eager to sit, believe it or not. And when I sit, I have a wonderful time, and this is just a great way of life as far as I'm concerned. It's helped me enormously in I can't tell you how many ways. And I very much enjoy practicing with other people. And many of us have been practicing for a number of years now. And it's just a pure pleasure. It's like pure joy. So I realize that Zen practice is not everybody's cup of tea. You know, people come here and try it out, and they may or may not say they're coming back, but a fair number of them don't come back, you know. And I understand, that's okay. And some people come and try this for a while, and they decide, this is just not what I want to do right now. And when I see them around on campus, I'm happy to see them, honestly. Sometimes they look nervously at me, you know, like I'm going to yell at them. But I'm not mad. That would be crazy, right? You know, it would be like being a guitar teacher or teacher of painting. And when somebody says they don't want to paint, you get mad at them. You know, that would be crazy. For some people, this path resonates deeply and has great significance. And those people are actually rather rare, and I'm very happy to meet them. And I'm thrilled to meet them, really. And it's just wonderful to practice with each of you. And when you come to sit, I notice you come in your arrival. And very happy. Really, I couldn't ask for a better life than practicing here with each of you. It really is a pure joy. So thank you for coming this morning and making my practice of Zen so rich and so wonderful because of sharing it with you. So today we're here, and I know that many people have a lot of pressure at this time of year. Some of you are taking exams, you're heavy into exams, and I know that it took some time. You probably have to go back to your rooms or to your apartments and study very hard for your exams, and yet you took time out to come here, and that's wonderful. I think this will help you with your exams. I really do. And I know that other people here are working under other kinds of deadlines, that not just exams, but other things too. And so I also know that some of you had to work very hard this week. And getting up on a Saturday is not always so easy. But here you are. So that's just wonderful. So we're all here practicing the way. And I have to say that there was really deep sitting in this room this morning. It was very, really impressive. For some reason, the heating system is not working properly. And I called just before we started to sit. And there's an emergency number. And somebody did come. The people who do this are serious. They seem to do a good job. And while we were reciting the sutras, one of the people stuck his head through the door and he saw us, and I had already explained the problem. But they haven't quite managed to work it out. And so you know, it's a little cooler in here than it usually is. And some people may have found it uncomfortable. I mean, it's in the low 60s. So that's not so bad, right? It could be the low 40s. That would be rough. And by the way, that would be more like, a temple in Japan. Or if it's 20 outside, it would be in the low 20s, sort of like that. Most of those sitting halls are not heated. And you might think that's crazy. I mean, it's the 21st century. Japan is a pretty wealthy country. They could put central heating in their temples, probably. But, you might have noticed this morning when you were sitting that being a little bit uncomfortable made your sit deeper. Maybe you noticed that. Nobody likes to be cold. Right? And we're not, terribly cold. It's about 5 or 6 degrees colder than normal in here. But nobody likes that. But the interesting thing is that when you're a little bit uncomfortable like that, you can do all kinds of, you can respond in all kinds of ways, You can sit there on the cushion and think, why did I come here this morning? It's so cold. Or you can think, I just hate the cold. Or you can think, I can't wait till I get out of here. I'm going to go back and turn on the heater in my apartment, or other things too, when it's cold, sometimes people say, think warm thoughts. That's kind of a joke. And in fact, trying to think warm thoughts when you're cold doesn't work very well. Many years ago, when I was training at the Seattle Zen Center, we built our own temple up in the mountains east of Seattle. And those are quite beautiful mountains. It's part of the Olympic, part of the Cascade Range. And it's a mountain range that stretches from the northern part of the state all the way down to the southern part of the state, and it divides Washington State almost in two. And the mountains are so high that they trap the rain that comes off of the ocean, and that's why it rains so much in Seattle. In fact, Seattle is really on the edge of a temperate zone rainforest. And these mountains, the Cascade Range, has stopped the clouds. And our temple was on the other side of the Cascade Range, the dry side. But it still got a lot of snow. It was quite a magnificent place. You could see, for 100 miles. It was up on a mountainside. And behind us was state forest or national forest, so it was never going to be developed. And we were right on the side of a mountain, and you could look out and just see the valleys and the mountains all around. It was quite dramatic. But it was cold. I don't mean in the low 60s. I mean really cold. And we used to have our fall and spring sesshins up there. And because we were trying to save a little money, instead of renting a place, we would try to use our temple property and use the money that we raised from the sesshin to pay for some shingles for the roof or this sort of thing. So, I can remember being so cold because we had built the temple, the sitting hall, the zendo. But there was no insulation, and it was just so cold. And I remember being seated next to a man whose name is John Godfrey, Eshin Godfrey. He is now the abbot of the Vancouver Zen Center in British Columbia. He was a very nice man from New Zealand. He was a huge guy. He was taller than I am, and he probably weighed, I mean, he probably weighed twice as much as I did at that time. I mean, really, he was probably like, 260. And he wasn't overweight. He was just, he had a huge, he was just really very, I'm sure he really wasn't 260, but he was huge. You know, he had giant hands, too, you know. And he was a very gentle person, sort of a gentle giant, you know. And he would be sitting there in the cold, and it must have just been, I don't know what, it might have been in the 20s, I really don't know. But he'd just be sitting there like no problem, you know. And I was sitting next to him, and it was just like, I was so cold, you know, and I had my coat on, I had my, you know, I had socks on, and I would just, my, literally just like shaking, you know, and I tried to think warm thoughts, you know, but it didn't do, in fact, it made it worse, but I did discover that there is a way of dealing with the cold. It's not thinking warm thoughts, but thinking no thoughts. Yeah. So you know, cold is very interesting. It's a little bit like pain because you can't really get away from it. It's just there, and every time you come out of your concentration, you notice the cold all around you. And so there's sort of like no escaping it. And it really was unbearable for me for a while, but then I just realized, you know, I'm going to have, the only thing I can do unless I want to leave the sesshin, and I couldn't do that because I didn't have a car. the only thing I could do was, you know, try to go into deep mushin, you know. So I would just really just throw myself into deep mushin, you know, really deep. And I noticed that when I was in deep mushin, I stopped shivering. I mean, this is, I swear this is true. I just stopped shivering. I became calm. I didn't have any responses, negative responses to the cold. And I felt very comfortable. And then, of course, when the bell would ring and I would undo my legs and start shaking again. So it really was a wonderful lesson because I could go into deep mushin and this cold would just disappear. And I can remember a number of sesshins like that where we had the zendo built and we had the kitchen built, and that was it at that time. And they were separate buildings because we didn't want the, you know, like a kitchen fire could set the whole temple on fire, so we made them separate buildings. And the kitchen was a wonderful little building with a wood-burning stove inside and a big picture window looking out over the valley. And everybody wanted to be in the kitchen detail during this sesshin because it was the one warm place, right? In it. And Roshi, the Sifu, Shifu, was doing Dokusan in the kitchen. But the Dokusan line was on a rug we had spread out on the pine needles. So we were sitting in the Dokusan line, and the snow was building up on our shoulders. That really was true. And I just realized there's only one way out of this, and just go deep into mushin. So this morning, I couldn't help but notice that it is a little colder than usual. And I couldn't help but notice how well everybody was sitting. I don't think it's just the cold, but it really helped. At the very last sit of the morning, we have five sits on Saturday morning. I noticed all of a sudden the row across from me. I was looking at the row across from me after. I have to confess that when I'm, during the sit, sometimes I look around to see how everybody's doing. And that's my job, really, is to make sure everybody's sitting well. And I suddenly looked at this row, and it's like, this was the last sit of the morning, and all of these people had pulled their legs up into the full lotus posture. So it was just like full lotus, full lotus, full lotus, full lotus. And everybody was sitting like a rock, right? Sitting like a rock. Very impressive. And really, you know, sometimes it's not possible to do that. Especially at the as the last sit, you know, you've been through four sits, and there's probably like a temptation to just say, I'll sort of make this one the easy one. But all these people had gone in the opposite direction and pulled those ankles up over their thighs, and the backs were straight, sitting very deeply. It was really wonderful to look at. This is the power of a mushin. You know, it's really, really amazing. It takes a while for people to discover the power of mushin. This story is about somebody who discovers mushin. At this time, Zen was getting established in China, and it was beginning to catch on. It had come to China from India, and when Zen arrived in China, Buddhism was already well established, and the conventional form of Buddhism was based upon doing good works and cleaning up karma. This was the way people understood the Dharma. So these are both very, very important, you know, doing good works and cleaning up karma. But there was a school of Buddhism known as Zen that showed up sort of late on the scene. And it said, you know, those are important, but enlightenment comes from seeing the nature of the mind directly. That you can do many good deeds in your life, and it's important to help others, because others are your true self. And compassion and action is the essence of a good life. But you can engage in compassionate action all your life and never wake up. And actually, you can clean up karma all your life and never wake up if you don't confront the mind face to face. And for this reason, the Zen people said, please read and study the sutras if you want. Yeah. But if you read and study the sutras from now until the end of time, you won't necessarily wake up unless you confront the mind face to face. See? So most of the schools of Buddhism at this time were very nervous about Zen. They didn't really like it very much, because it didn't seem to have the right... it didn't stress studying the sutras. It didn't stress cleaning up karma. It didn't stress doing good deeds. It didn't say not to do those things, but it said, ultimately, liberation comes from seeing your own true nature. See, encountering enlightened mind, which is your true mind, face to face. And so most of the schools of Buddhism at this time looked at Zen as heretical, you could say, as not true Buddhism, as bad, really. There was a teacher at this time whose name was, Shu was his name, and he was an expert, a scholar on the Diamond Sutra, and he was actually called Diamond Shu. because he was the foremost scholar on the implications of the Diamond Sutra in China at that time. And he went all over China lecturing on the Diamond Sutra. And he had a beautifully developed discriminating intellect. He was a real scholar, really brilliant person. And there's nothing wrong with this, but his attachment to ideas and concepts made him rigid. It had made him rigid. And one day he was giving a lecture on the Diamond Sutra, and somebody asked him about Zen, the Zen sect. And he had never heard of Zen, and he said, "What do they teach?" And the person says, "They claim to be a transmission outside the sutras. They say that you can read the sutras if you want to, but it won't help you to wake up." And when Diamond Shu heard this, he was very upset. He was really angry. And he was convinced that this was like a malicious teaching. And so he said, "Well, you know, I'm going to confront those Zen people and show them the error of their ways." Anyway, he wanted to take on the Zen sect. And he set off to the heartland of the area in China where Zen was being practiced most widely. And he came to a place in his travels where it was like a restaurant, we would say, or a diner today. It was an inn. A roadside inn, and it was owned and managed and run by an old woman. And so Diamond Shu came to this restaurant, this diner, and he said, he sat down and he said, "I would like some, I'm not going to pronounce this right, but Tianxin. The word, as I understand it, is like a snack, tianxin. In Seattle, I used to go to a restaurant that used to sell tianxin, and it was like a snack, and it literally means mind refreshment. So he went into this diner and he said, "I'd like a little tianxin, a little mind refreshment." Now, this old woman wasn't an ordinary old woman. She was somebody who was deeply awake. And she said, "Aren't you Diamond Shu, the great Diamond Sutra scholar?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, I have a question for you, Diamond Shu, Reverend Sir. In the Diamond Sutra, it says actually that there's no essential nature to past mind, there's no essential nature to present mind, and there's no essential nature to future mind. So what mind are you going to refresh?" Now, this question stunned Diamond Shu, because in all of his study, he had never looked directly at the mind, only at the products of the mind. And he was a very good-hearted person, very noble person, but he had become trapped on the level of words and ideas, which are quite important, but limiting. And this question was like, it just went down into the core of his being. Sometimes things happen to us and they're trivial and they leave no mark. But sometimes somebody can say something to us and we just can't put it down. You know, and maybe it bothers us and eventually we let go. But sometimes things, you know, they just pierce us right to the heart. Well, this just pierced Diamond Shu right to the heart. He realized something was wrong with the way he was living. And because he was a basically noble person, he didn't just brush off this old woman, this awakened old woman. He said it with great humility, you know, is there somebody who can teach me more? And she said, you should go see old Tokusan, who lives up on that mountain there. So Diamond Shu goes up to study with Tokusan. And remember, he had come looking for Zen people that he could argue with and convince that they were on the wrong path. But now he's begun to have doubts about his own path. So he goes up to Tokusan's temple and becomes a trainee at Tokusan's temple. And he trains for many years. But he's addicted to discriminating thought. So every day he sits on the cushion and he does meditation. But all the time he's thinking, you know, he's sitting there on the cushion going, well, is this what the Diamond Sutra meant when it said blah, 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 blah? Is this samadhi? Or is this samadhi? See? And he keeps inquiring with his discriminating mind. And then he goes into Dokusan. And he talks and talks and talks with his teacher. And so his old teacher just puts up with this. Puts up with this day after day, day after day, day. And Diamond Shu just keeps sitting and thinking and sitting and thinking. One night, one afternoon, he goes into Dokusan, and they talk and talk and talk and talk. And finally, his teacher, his old teacher, says, "Look, I've had enough of our conversation." And he lifts the blinds, and it's night outside. So the old teacher gives Diamond Shu a candle to take with him back to the Zendo. And as Diamond Shu takes the candle, the old teacher blows it out. So he blows it out. And at that moment, Diamond Shu suddenly confronts the nature of his mind as Mu Xin. He suddenly has a deep experience of Mu Xin. Yeah? And this is the beginning of his path to liberation, to awakening. And the next day, during a Taisho, the old teacher says, I see somebody here who's finally encountered Mu Xin, and he's going to be a great Zen teacher because he's finally freed himself from the limits of discriminating intellect. So this is really quite a beautiful story. I wanted to read you something else too. Another little story, if I can. A Zen monk named Chur Huang, who had previously sought instruction from the fifth ancestor of Zen, and thought that he himself had attained the state of deep samadhi, stayed for 20 years in a small temple where he used to sit in meditation all the time. Xuanzi, a disciple of the fifth ancestor, when wandering from place to place, one day reached the north bank of the Yellow River, where he heard the name of the Chan monk. Xuanzi came to see him and asked, "What are you doing here?" Chi Huang said, "I'm in deep samadhi." He said, "Deep samadhi." Xuanzi asked, "So you say you're in deep samadhi, but are you mindful or unmindful of how you enter deep samadhi?" So there's a monk who's living, has been practicing in a small temple for 20 years. He says, "I'm in deep samadhi." And another monk comes and encounters him and says, "So when you sit, what happens to you?" The monk who's been practicing for 20 years says, "Oh, I go right into deep samadhi." Now this other monk is very deeply awake, and he's going to give this other monk a test. He's going to pose a Zen question to him to see if his samadhi is genuine or not. So Xuanzi asks Chi Huang, "You say you're in samadhi, but let me test you. Are you mindful or unmindful of the way you enter samadhi?" So you could ask yourself this question right now. When you go into deep mushin, are you mindful or unmindful of the way you go into deep mushin? Now, the monk says, if you are unmindful, all inanimate things such as grass, plants, tiles, and stones should be in samadhi with you. If you are mindful, all living things, all animate things, should also be in samadhi, such as birds, deer, crickets, etc. So the monk is testing the other monk. And the monk who's testing says, if you pay attention to the way you go into samadhi, all the animals and living things will also be in samadhi with you. And he says, if you don't pay attention to the way you go into samadhi, only stones, trees, wood, and so on will be. Now, let me just say, this is complete. In English, we have a wonderful expression. It's called bullshit. This is bullshit, right? Okay. This is a beauty. So he's saying, let me explain my philosophy of samadhi. Now, Chi Huang replied, when I enter samadhi, I am mindless of is and is not. I don't know anything about how I enter samadhi or how I exit samadhi. I don't know anything about sentient beings being in samadhi or non-sentient beings being in samadhi. I just go into mushin, see? And when I'm in mushin, there's no is and there's no is not. Just mushin. No concept is arising. The story's a little more complicated, but that's a good answer. Yeah. So he's experienced deep mushin. In deep mushin, there's no self-consciousness, no comparisons, no analysis, no judgment or assessment. You know, we live in a world which places a tremendous importance on our ability to think with a discriminating mind. And many of you are taking exams on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. And I hope when you leave here, if you have to study, you have some lunch and you get a little rest. And then I hope you study with great diligence. Very important to use your discriminating intellect as fully as you can. When you sit on the cushion and you're really practicing, you encounter another kind of intelligence, which is impossible really to describe if you haven't been there. But it's tremendously liberating. You know, I'm sure you all understand this. You know, you sit down on the cushion, and all thoughts gradually become fewer and fewer, and little by little the mind becomes blanker and blanker, and you may have moments where there's really no thought arising. And in those moments, there's just this, I think, if you stay there long enough, you will agree with me that there's this powerful sense of connection, powerful sense of being alive, you know, just pure joy at being alive, a pure like life energy. You know, this week I've had a difficult week myself. I had so much to do this week, and I have to say I'm a little tired this morning. You know, like everybody else, I have things that produce tension. You know, like everybody else, you know, I have deadlines. I have events that occur that create friction. You know, that cause tension, that produce misunderstandings, and so on. And when I came in here to sit, it was Friday night, and I was really tired, you know, really tired. And I sat down on the cushion, and about halfway through the evening, I just felt like this deep energy, just like, really, it was just like, it was as though I was, it was like I was had been like burned out and dead. And I was just sort of going through the motions, sitting on the cushion, and just trying to get through the sit, you know, because I'm tired. All of a sudden, I just realized, wow, I feel so good. I feel so alive. And, you know, I came in this morning, and even though I'm tired, you know, you sit on the cushion and go into deep mushin, and there's just this, it's like an indestructible life energy that you can tap into. And I think this is, you can't always plug in. You know, sometimes you sit on the cushion and it just doesn't happen. You know, you're tired and you're plugging away and just nothing clicks. And that happens, right? You can't make it happen. And there's moments in your practice where you go through a period where you're just not hitting it. It's like a dry spell, you know? You have a sit and nothing happens. You have a sit and nothing happens, you know? But then all of a sudden, you know, you can sit down on the cushion and it just turns around and it's like suddenly you're plugged into the universe. It's like the energy of the universe is flowing through your body. I think maybe other people were feeling that energy too. You know, when I looked around and I saw these people with their legs up, back straight, you know, I think they were feeling that same energy. You know, where does that come from? It's just amazing. The power of discriminating thought is its ability to arrest the flow of life and make a change look the same. You know, the power of thought is to stop the flow. It's like freeze the frame. And then to say, this moment is just like this moment. And that this moment is just like that moment, even though they aren't really, in a certain sense. You know, and it's very important to be able to do that. You can do many wonderful things with the discriminating intellect. You can maybe find a cure for cancer. You can, perhaps you can invent a cold fusion nuclear reactor. That would be great. You know, who knows what you can do with your discriminating intellect? But there's this other mind too that's very, very important and much neglected in the modern world. And these are like two hands of one body, I think. So, you know, being a well-developed person means that you have you cultivate your abilities, your intellect, and your imagination and your other abilities, and you live that life, you know. But at the same time, you know, you have this other deeper connection to the world, a deeper connection through a bigger mind. And when these two minds are working together, you know, it's like a fully developed human being. This is like a fully developed human being. So Diamond Shu was like somebody who was like lopsided, you know? It's like one side of his brain was well developed and the other side was undeveloped. And consequently, he became rigid and, caught. You know, thoughts, ideas, they're creations of human beings. They're not real. They have a practical value and a temporary value, but they're not real. And he became a prisoner of his intellectual life. But then he discovered this other, he discovered this deeper mind, this Mushin. And he became like a great Zen teacher, great Zen master. And I would say like a fully developed human being. So you have that intelligence and that compassion. You have that wonderful intellect and also that powerful sense of connectedness to everything around you, which usually people with well-developed intellects don't have. So today, some people blew out the candle, and that was just wonderful. So I thank you for coming today. I wish you luck in your challenges this coming week, your exams or your tests or whatever life is going to throw at you. And please use your Mu power to do what you have to do. And in life we have successes and we have failures. That's part of a life. And, I've not always been successful at the things I do, and that's still true. And that's still true today. If you do anything in life, you're going to encounter failure. That's absolutely guaranteed. You know, only people who don't encounter failure are people who don't try to do anything. And the loftier your goals, the more likely failure is going to be, right? Right now, you have somebody like Hillary Clinton. You have Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are both trying to run for president. You might want to vote for Mrs. Clinton and you might want to vote for Obama. I think if you're fair about it, you would say that both of them are qualified. And both of them, I think, would be good presidents. Really, I think could be wonderful presidents. Who knows? Only one of them is going to get to be the candidate, you know? And somebody's going to go home brokenhearted, right? Somebody. And not just Hillary or not just Barack Obama, but all their supporters, you know. Some people are going to be brokenhearted, you know. So if you try to do something in life, it doesn't always work. That's absolutely guaranteed. And one of the things that this can do for you is, you know, before your exam, please do some zazen, you know? And then after your exam, do some zazen, right? Because if you get an A, do some zazen and have a wonderful sit and enjoy your sit. And if you're brokenhearted, because you didn't get your A, you really need to sit on the cushion and have a bigger sense of bigger perspective, right? Life is many days. Life is many days. You know, we don't always win. You know, there's just, if you try, you're going to fail sometime. But some people are crippled by their failures, and some people know the secret. You know, people who practice the path. This path know the secret, you know, of indestructible energy, you know. So you know, you can have experiences that just crush you, you know, that just crush you. But if you can do this, if you can enter Deep Machine, you sit, you're dead on the cushion, you know, you're crushed. I swear, I'm speaking from personal experience. You could say, oh, you've never, believe me. Everybody, if you try anything in life, you're going to have experiences that just crush you sometime. And you think, that's it. That's it. And you sit on the cushion, and you go into Deep Mushin, and you're dead, 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 dead. And all of a sudden, it's like, you know, it's all of a sudden there's this beautiful energy. And it's like you come back from the dead. You come back from the crushed. And your heart is alive, and you feel joy again, and you can get off the cushion and go back. You know, maybe Mrs. Clinton does zazen. We don't know. Maybe Barack Obama does zazen. I hope so, you know. Because it's very hard when life crushes you to bounce back. But believe me, if you do this practice, you make this part of your life, I swear to you, you'll bounce back every time. It's like indestructible energy, indestructible life, indestructible joy. So, thank you for coming today.